PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. This episode features PERC Executive Director Dino Falaschetti at the 2012 Freedom Fest presenting on Growth is Green.
I want to introduce this topic, but I want to introduce myself to you as well. A lot of you are familiar with PERC, but not familiar with me. This is my first full week on the job. I am the new executive director of PERC, the Property Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. And I'm really excited to join the leadership team there. And what PERC does is we try to create property rights over environmental goods and services. And the story is actually pretty easy, right? I mean, have you taken your rental car in for service anytime soon? No, you haven't. Why? You don't have the property right to the car. You don't have an economic stake in the car. So we tend not to take care of our rental cars as well as we take care of our own cars. And I'm a PhD economist, and even amongst PhD economists, the story is markets work, except, and then depending on where you're at on the spectrum, determines how long the list is, how long the except list is. The environment frequently turns up on that list. Markets work except for the environment. And our story is, hey, look, if markets work and they just rely on some pretty fundamental political legal foundations, then they should work in any market, whether it's a financial market or an environmental market. And so what we try to do is to lay that political legal foundation, that property right foundation for the environment. And I'll go through a good number of programs that we are running and show what I think is pretty compelling evidence that this is not just chalkboard economics. When it hits the ground, it actually works. All right? And the way I want to introduce this topic on growth and growth is green, I'm going to bring together some economics, some law, some politics, and I want to give you some background on myself just to give you a context of, where is this guy coming from. I did part of my education at the University of Chicago. Great school, right? Milton Friedman, Gary Becker, guys that turned me on to economics. And I'm taking a class from the Nobel Prize winner, Bob Lucas, on macroeconomics. And I'm studying, I'm working hard. It was a hard class. And I'm getting it, and I'm so excited. This works. I'm so excited. Markets work. I'm so excited. I look out the window. I'm in President Obama's district, and nothing's working. Nothing's working, right? I mean, this place is a disaster. You get off a campus on the University of Chicago, and there's a really good chance that you're going to get shot. Chicago regularly competes for the murder capital of the United States, and that neighborhood competes for the murder capital of Chicago, right? Markets work. I'm learning it from the best people the planet has ever known, and it's not working around me, right? It's not working in that neighborhood. There's something else going on. There's something else going on, and that something else is politics, right? So I've had a number of academic positions. I've been a tenured professor of economics, a tenured professor in a law school. I've been appointed in political science departments. And one way to look at my career is, wow, this guy doesn't know what he wants to do, right? I do know what I want to do. I wanted to become a good economist because I thought I could make the world a better place by just knowing economics. But I looked out the window in that Bob Lucas class, and I knew I couldn't do well just with economics. I had to know something about the law. I had to know something about policy. Right, and I eventually got to work in the White House, and if we have time, I'll be able to share a short story with you that I think it's not on environmentalism, but I think it illustrates the points, the fundamental points that we're trying to discuss here. But that's the context in what I want to talk about, growth is green, because what we frequently see now is, at least in political discussions, we see a dichotomy there, don't we? We see that, okay, well, look, we've got to make a choice. We either have to choose policies that are pro-growth or we have to choose policies that are good for the environment, and we can't have both. And my message is, and I think it's just good economics, is that there's no dichotomy here. They're the same thing. They're the same thing. Growth is green. Think about it. What is economic growth? Right? What is economic growth? There is as much stuff on the planet Earth today as there ever has been. There are a couple garbage bags floating in space, but that's it, right? We've got it all right here. It hasn't gone anywhere. But why are we so much richer today than we ever have been? It's because we're making more with less. That's economic growth. You make more with less. That's the only way you can have sustainable economic growth. You can get little blips by making more with more, but you're never going to get sustainable on the scale that the United States has over tens, 50s, hundreds of years without making more with less. Well, isn't more with less, isn't that conservation? Isn't more with less conservation? Isn't more with less sustainable? Economic growth is green. There is no dichotomy here. There is no dichotomy here. So why do we hear it? Why do we hear it? Again, I'm a PhD economist. I used to think I'm a really smart guy, and all I have to do is teach people what I know. And if you're as smart as I am, you'll get it, and then you'll do it. Right? And I kept, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Right? The problem, as far as I could see, it's not, and I'm not saying there aren't dumb people out there. There probably are. But if you want to go around and be a university professor and just hope that the world works, well, you teach them the right thing and everybody's going to behave according to the economic models, good luck, right? It's not going to work. Why? Because economics is about efficiency. Economics is about mechanisms, political legal mechanisms that expand the pie in general, right? About expanding the pie in general. And I ask my students sometimes, they get really excited at this point. They get it. They say, oh, yeah, we're going to expand the pie in general. Dino, go out and run for the president of the United States. I said, no, it'll never work. The efficiency president will never work. Why? How do you win an election as the efficiency president? Anybody vote for the size of the pie? You vote for the slice of your pie, don't you? All right? That's how we tend to vote, right? I mean, there are good people in this room. I'm not denigrating you. But, you know, when you look at the data, that's kind of how we vote in large scale, right? The way you win the election is the room's kind of split half and half. I take, you know, the 50% over here. I take one of you. I change the aisle. I say, hey, look, we're going to take all their money and we're giving it to you. Do I have your vote? Yes. Right? That's kind of politics. Politics about the distribution. And so now we've got a pretty tight political race. And I'm looking for, you know, economic distributive policies to win the election. And I say to myself, wow, it's going to be a little bit too close. It doesn't look like I'm going to win just on the economic dimension of the political race. So what else could I do? Well, a tried and true political strategy is if you're going to lose on this dimension, add another dimension to the debate. You might win in the two-dimensional space where you wouldn't win in the one-dimensional space. And so what we see a lot of times is we see green wrapping of bad economic policy, right? It's a green wrapper about bad economic policy because you couldn't get the bad economic policy in on your own, and so you put a green wrapper around it. And I'll tell you a couple of illustrations of how I think this stuff hits the ground, and I'll talk about some of what PERC is doing to hopefully make the world a better place on this dimension, and I'll share some concluding comments. If we have time, I'd love to hear from you as well. Couple of short stories on green wrapping bad economic policy. I just moved to lovely Bozeman, Montana from Seattle, Washington. We had a great place in Seattle. We were looking over the Cascades. We had, you know, if Mount Rainier went off, we were going to be the first ones to know. We had a great view of Mount Rainier. And Puget Sound Energy, that's the energy company for Seattle, Puget Sound Energy. And there was a big green movement. We had these old light bulbs in our place. Right? We had about 20 old light bulbs in our, we were renting a condo. And, you know, we were told these are very inefficient light bulbs. They worked, but they were inefficient. They were taking up too much energy. So the good folks from Puget Sound Energy came by. Three of them came by, right? There are all sorts of jokes, how many people it takes to screw in a light bulb. Took three of these folks. They came over, three people came over. We had 33 floors in our building. We live in a complex that had two towers, so that's 66 floors. We had 20 working light bulbs in our building. Take 33 times 2 times 20. That's how many light bulbs got taken out by three guys, thrown into the landfill. And then the new light bulbs went in. And these are light bulbs that we were told supposed to last for 20 years. They left. I turned on the kitchen lights. One of them was out. I ran to the elevator, and I caught them before they even got to the elevator to come out and replace. One had already burned out. These are 20-year light bulbs, and they already threw out all the bulbs that worked. Right? They had to come out and unscrew that one, and they couldn't just throw these guys in the landfill because these bulbs, they last for 20 years, and they have mercury in them, and you've got to put them in like some hazmat process that I don't understand. I mean, this is nonsense. How is this? This is the growth or green, isn't it? This is the growth or green. How does this happen? How does this happen? You're green wrapping bad economic policy. Bad economic, this is like cash for clunkers. How is destroying working capital growth? Right? It's not. But if you green wrap it, put a green wrapper on it, a lot of people are going to swallow it. And another one of my, this might be, I still have hopefully a while to live, this could be my all-time favorite program, though. And it's called the American Great Outdoors. And I'm not making this up. This is an administrative, the administration, the current administration hopes this is going to be a policy. The American Great Outdoors. Go to the administration's website, search for this thing. Very nice, glossy, colorful brochure showing the American Great Outdoors, people enjoying hiking. It's kind of like, you know, Bozeman, Montana and Yellowstone Country. First five pages telling us how great the outdoors is. You get it. You turn to page six or so of the program, and what's the first objective of the American Great Outdoors? This is their words, not mine. Jobs. Jobs. Hey, this is the American Great Outdoors. What does the American Great Outdoors have to do with jobs? Well, how do you get votes? I'm from South Chicago, folks, right? I grew up in President Obama's district. You want people's votes, you give them a job. That's how it works, right? You give them a job. And it gets even better, right? So now we've got employment in the parks. We're putting people to work. These are good people. We're putting them to work. We've got their vote. And guess what? We have national health care now, don't we? We've got national health care. And there's a listening tour for the American Great Outdoors. And when the docs got together on the listening tour, you know what they cooked up? Park prescriptions. You know what that is? Park prescriptions? Doctors get together on the listening tour. You got a great American Great Outdoors over there. You've already paid your tax dollars for the health care, for the job. Now you can go to the doctors that you're already paying. I'm sick. I've got just the prescription for you. Go to the park. You could have a prescription if this is successful. You could have a prescription to come out and visit us in Yellowstone. It's going to be good for our economy, not for yours, right? Where's the value created here? You know, at some point, you go around this circle and you bump right back into yourself, don't you? You paid the taxes for the health care, and then you got the prescription. Then you went to the park and you're paying that guy in there. And then you come home and you're like, oh my goodness, I don't have any more money. That's the most expensive park visit I ever had. And this is just absolute bananas, right? This is, I don't get it. I don't get the economics of it. Maybe we could all go, right? So that's what I want to talk about, is that this is clearly nuts on the economics, but the politics of this is super hard. And one of the things that I've always loved about PERC is PERC is not just a think tank, but a do tank. It's not leaving the ideas on the chalkboard, but it's putting them into action. And so let me talk about a couple of the programs where actually, and again, this is hard stuff. You can see this is hard stuff. It's hard politically. The economics of it isn't that difficult, but the politics is really hard. And so let me share with you a couple of our successes. One is conserving rhinoceros in Africa. And so the short story there is that for a long time, there weren't property rights over the rhinoceros. There's markets for parts of the rhinoceros, especially for the horn. And so nobody owns the rhinoceros. And so what happens to the rhinoceros? Everybody goes out and shoots them, lops off their horn, just leaves them there to decay or to be eaten, and pretty soon there are no rhinoceros. So a couple of African countries got this, and they started putting prices on the rhinoceros. And they set the prices initially, they set the prices too low. And when you set the price too low and you don't put any property rights on the rhinoceros, you really haven't solved the problem, because what happens is the folks who buy the rhinoceros at the suppressed price, they don't have a property right over it. So what they're doing is they're really afraid that a poacher is going to come along, kill the rhinoceros before the optimal time, and they're going to be left with nothing, right? Because if you buy low, you have to wait a while for the appreciation to take place. And so they kept disappearing, and eventually a couple of countries got it right. They put auctions on the rhinoceros, and the market price of the rhinoceros ballooned. And, more importantly, the population of the rhinoceros rebounded as well. Why? You've got this asset, a really valuable asset, right? This is your car. You're taking care of it. and they stop disappearing. And I love this figure. And some of these pamphlets are out at our booth 106. Is it 106? 106. So this is, the black rhinoceros are governed in a certain set of countries without the property rights. That's the black bars. And this is, these are data from about 1960 until almost today. The white rhinoceros in a different set of African countries where these property right regimes were introduced. This is pretty simple, isn't it? You see what happens to the black rhinoceros, you see what happens to the white rhinoceros. You introduce the property rights, you give people a stake, an economic stake in the rhinoceros, and this is good for the local economies, and obviously the white rhinoceros love this stuff.
When was the policy enacted? Was it right at the beginning?
There's a lot of variation in the policy, so these are just the raw data. You certainly see the correlation, but that's a very good point. So when you put in, you have to layer on, there's this period where there's the suppressed price. And then there's a period where you get the suppressed price with property rights, and it doesn't really take off until you see a trend break when you actually get the auction with the property rights. That's when the trend break, statistically speaking, takes place in those data. But that's a good point, that these are just the raw correlations. So this has been a very successful program for us. We work with a lot of affiliates, a lot of local affiliates to help implement these programs. Another is in fisheries. And so a lot of fisheries around the world are being depleted at unsustainable rates. And Don Leal is our lead on fisheries at PERC. And he's done a lot of great work with the World Bank in introducing a mechanism called catch shares. And faced with the consequences of these fisheries depreciating at such a rapid rate, what countries started to do is getting together and putting quotas on the fishery. So, say, 10,000 fish could come out in a certain period of time in this geographic area. Well, that actually exacerbated the problem. It didn't make it any better. You know, I mean, sir, your first pass at it would say, hey, wouldn't that make it better? You can only take out 10,000. Well, it didn't, and here's why. Think about if there are only 10,000 fish out there, and anybody can go get them, right? If my boat's a little bit bigger than your boat, I'm getting almost all of them, right? This is like if somebody wants to hack your computer, all you have to do is have a little bit more protected of a computer than the next guy. You don't have to have a super protected, just a little bit better than the next guy. Right? It's the same sort of logic there. So if my boat's a little bit bigger than yours, I'm going to get a ton more fish. So what do? You get an even bigger boat. Now we're into an arms race, right? So what you saw under the quota system, you saw these just huge ships, and we got a good picture of this. These huge ships, right, going after less and less fish. And in addition to the quota system, the season is just a certain length of time. And say the weather's super bad. You shouldn't be out on the water that day. Well, if you don't go out, I'm going out, right? Pretty soon we're all out there in the worst weather, and literally we're killing ourselves. So the guys that are working on the boats, the accident rates were huge. The death rates were big. The boats were big. And the fish are disappearing. They're still disappearing. And that's where the catch shares come in. So rather than putting a quota of 10,000 in general, now my boat has a right that can be traded, and this is important, for 500. Your boat might have one for 1,000. Your boat might have one for 2,000. The weather's bad today. Hey, man, I got 500. I'm sleeping in, right? I'm going out the next day. You got 1,000? Same thing. Your boat's bigger than mine? I don't care. I'm getting 500. I happen to be a really bad fisherman. If I had a right to 500 fish, I probably wouldn't get them. I went out with my father-in-law recently. I didn't get any. What would I do with my 500, my right to 500? I'd sell it, right? Because if you're better than I am, your willingness to pay for it is a lot more than mine. And so what you see is you see these rights migrating to their highest value use. Growth is green. Right? We're putting property rights on these environmental assets. They're migrating to their highest valued uses. The fisheries are coming back. The quotas are actually being expanded in some of these areas because the fish are actually coming back as well. In the last program, and we have a lot of programs, if you want to visit PERC.org, we talk a lot more about a lot of those other programs there, is a conference we're going to do over the summer on environmental finance. And you see the problem here is contracting over environmental services. And all financial services are just contracts. That's all they are, is just contracts, right? A lot of people think about finance as money. Well, it's not money. Finance is not money. Finance is money with rules written around it governing how you can use that money. And so we want to understand better how we can structure financial contracts to conserve environmental resources. So you can imagine even having, and we've done a little bit of this work in Florida and in related areas, you could have climate insurance, right? Hey, I'm going to be damaged by climate change. In the event that that occurs, now I've got some insurance. That's just a financial contract. And we're going to have some really just fantastic academics, as well as policymakers and business people. Because again, we're not a think tank. We're not just leaving the ideas on the board. We're going to have the best thinkers in the world there, figuring this stuff out. But we also need people to be able to put them into action. So the story so far is that the economics of this stuff is pretty simple, and especially for a group like this, you kind of get that property rights work. It's that, markets don't fail. We don't call North Korea a market failure, do we? Right? It's a political legal failure. If the political legal climate's not there, there's no reason markets will work. We don't say the Soviet Union markets just didn't work there. That'd be silly. Okay, we need the right political legal institutions for markets to work. So the economics is pretty easy, but the politics is hard. And I think this figure really illustrates well just how hard it is. This is per capita income across the world from year zero to year 2000. And they're in today's dollars. And so if you follow along with me, from year zero to about year 1000, what that flat line at the bottom, notice that the whole world is there. There's no income inequality in that world. Everybody is dirt poor. That's $500 per capita per year, right, in today's dollars. From year 1000 to about year 1800, we're, economic boom times, $1,000 a year per capita. Okay. Again, you don't see any income inequality there. You don't see any recessions there, right? How do you have a recession when you have $500 a year? There's nowhere to go, right? There are no business cycles there. Nobody cares about that stuff. And then what do you see around the time of the Glorious Revolution in Great Britain, the introduction of property rights, the kind of stuff that we're talking about here? Boom, right? And it's the Western offshoots, the United States, Canada, Australia. That's what's at the top of that graph on the far right end, on your far right end. But what you also notice is that not everybody gets it. Look, folks, anybody in the world could get economic books from Amazon. It's not that hard, right? You think Kim Jong-il, when he was alive, look how poor the place is. If I only understood economics 101, then I could make the place a lot better. Right, I've got another slide. It's not in this deck, but it's an aerial photo of the Korean Peninsula at night. You don't need any lines to see South Korea. All the lights are on. North Korea's got one light on. It's Kim Jong-il's place, right? He doesn't care about anybody else. His place is working well. He's happy to take and not make, right? That's the fundamentally hard problem that we all in this room, I think, have to deal with. And let me share with you a short story from my time at the White House on how this hits the ground in the United States. And again, I'm just trying to illustrate the forces that are up against us. I got to the White House in 2005, about a month before Hurricane Katrina. I was hired to do a lot of things, but I asked one of my colleagues, what should I do when I go? I was at the Council of Economic Advisors under Chairman Ben Bernanke and Eddie Lazier. What should I be briefing myself on? He said, don't worry about it. Something's going to happen. You have no idea what it's going to be, and you're just going to have to deal with it when it comes. Well, Hurricane Katrina hit about a month afterward, and we were dealing with it for the whole year. And I won't go into any of the details on what happened at the beginning of the year, but toward the end of the year, people weren't coming back to New Orleans, and people, Republican and Democrat, were wringing their hands. How are we going to get people to move right back into harm's way, which I had been arguing maybe we shouldn't do that. But nonetheless, how are we going to get them to come back? Well, they weren't coming back in part because property insurers weren't willing to come back. And why weren't property insurers willing to come back? Well, some of you may recall that the AG, the Attorney General from Mississippi, he had characterized the property insurers as, and these are his words, not mine, Nazis walking in lockstep over the good people of Mississippi. Well, why are you going to go back into that political legal climate? What was happening, the litigation was such that if a hurricane, you can have damage from water, you can have damage from wind, but most folks only have wind protection. They don't have enough flood insurance. Flood insurance is a federal program. So what they were doing is they were funneling in the flood losses into the wind policy. And so you wrote a contract to protect against wind damage, and now you're on the hook for both, right? The terms of the contract were being changed after the fact and in the favor of the voters and not in the favor of the insurers. So they weren't coming back. In one of the last meetings I was in at the White House, it was with about 14 CEOs of the biggest insurers, names that you would recognize, and the chairman of Gulf Coast Reconstruction, Chairman Powell, former chairman of the FDIC, was the White House director for Gulf Coast Redevelopment. And the chairman of Gulf Coast Redevelopment got to the edge of his chair, big table, very nice room in the old executive office building, said, "Guys, what's it going to take you to come back? What's it going to take you to come back? You're not coming back. What's it going to take you?" I mean, notice what he's saying, essentially. At least this is how I would interpret it. I've got the checkbook of the United States of America sitting in front of me, and all I'm asking you guys is how many zeros do I put after that? You know, I'm going to put a one down, and then you tell me how many zeros you want. One of the CEOs of the insurers got to the edge of his chair, and he said, "Mr. Chairman, we're not coming back at any price. We're not coming back at any price." And the reason why these guys weren't coming back, because they knew it didn't matter how many zeros you put after the one, the rules were going to change as soon as a new storm hit, right? We wrote 6 zeros after it, well, we're going to hit you for 7. We wrote 7, we're going to hit you for 8, right? It's those politics. That is what is fundamentally hard. How do you get these programs to work? How do you take the green wrapper off of bad economic policy in this kind of environment? And that's the kind of work that PERC does. And so let me conclude, and we'll have time for some questions, with a quote from Margaret Thatcher when she eulogized President Reagan. She said that freedom comes at a terrible price. God help us if we don't do something worthwhile with it. God help us if we don't do something worthwhile with our freedom. Well, one of the reasons I'm so proud of joining PERC is because PERC is using free market environmentalism to win for the environment and for the economy. And you can see that this is hard work. I think it's important work. And we welcome you to join us as a consumer of PERC products and a supporter as well. Go to PERC.org. We've got the whole deck up there. It's sort of just an account of some of the comments made here. We welcome you to go there. My colleague Laura Huggins, Director of Outreach, is in our audience. We have some materials here for your information as well, and I'm happy to take your questions. Yes, sir. I wouldn't know what to do with it either. But what you can do with it, apparently you can harvest the horns. So one, you could start a game ranch, right? Apparently you can. Apparently they're like thumbnails. So you can, you know, if you do it properly, okay? But if you don't have a property right over it, you're not interested in the future. Well, think about it like this. It's kind of like if you were a cattle rancher. Right, you can buy a cow and you can get milk from the cow. So you're sort of just generally getting some revenue from that cow. That would be like buying the rhinoceros and then sort of harvesting the horn, taking the milk out of it. Or you can slaughter the cattle, and you can make beef out of it. Right. Well, you could also make game ranches out of a lot of these animals. And in fact, this is a good example. Some of you may have seen, what was it, a month or so ago on 60 Minutes, there was a story on game ranches in Texas, and a lot of these endangered species in Africa are doing just fine on these game ranches. Right, they're game ranches, folks. They get shot. Right? Why in the world would they come back? Because they got a price on their head. Right? There's a stake. People people, you know, protect their cattle. It's an economic state. They're thriving down in Texas. Well, there is now a change in the rules. And that change, getting back to sort of how politically difficult it is, this change now requires or is going to require the game ranchers to get a special permit from the United States government to be able to harvest these endangered species, because they're still endangered species. And the cost of getting this permit now looks like it's going to make this ranch, these ranches, this business, it doesn't make any economic sense. And guess who's pushing for this? You're going to love this. Well, it's the environmentalists, but it's a great organization called, and I'm not making this up, Friends of Animals. Doesn't sound like Friends of Animals to me, right? I mean, the animals have already disappeared from the places where there are no property rights. And now they're pushing for taking away the property, essentially taking away the property rights from these game ranchers down in Texas. But as far as the rhinos go, sort of, you know, you could think about it in terms of, you know, how we use cattle in the United States on some of these ranches.
To learn more about free market environmentalism, visit www.perc.org.